This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com. From the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking try free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title the Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for September 14th, 2017, the What Happened edition. I am David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. Here with me in Washington, D.C., John Dickerson of Face the Nation. Hello, John.
Hi.
And Emily Beazelbub of the New York Times Magazine is in New York. Hello, Emily Bazelon.
Hello, hello. So you added punctuation to Hillary Clinton's book title, I noticed. Making it your own with that question mark.
Yes. I'm not sure how I said it. I just sort of said it loud. Mostly I said it loudly.
You said it as a question.
That's true. I guess that's right. Is it not a question? I don't think I noticed that.
There's no punctuation.
You can take it any way you want, man. Narrative is your narrative, and my narrative is my narrative.
Oh, man. Wow. That's groovy on this groovy show.
It could also explain what happened to the beginning of this show.
On this week's Gabfest, is Donald Trump an independent president forging a new path that will destroy the two-party system? Then Hillary Clinton's election memoir arrives. Does she deserve the beating she's taking for it in some quarters and the praise in others? More beating than praise from what I've seen. Then a new book from Frank Foer warns that big tech companies are changing how culture is made, how we think, who we are. Is it all as bad as he said? It is hashtag alarmism. Plus, we will have cocktail chatter. And just to remind you, we've got 2 live shows coming up. Each show has a fantastic guest. So we're ready to announce that our live show in Chicago on October 25th at the Reskin Theater, we're going to have a special guest, Kim Fox, who is the state attorney of Cook County. Emily, tell us a little bit about Kim Fox, who's going to be awesome.
Kim Fox was elected. This is the role of district attorney for the city of Chicago, although David did say her title properly. She was elected in November 2016 on a reform agenda coming in the wake of a lot of unrest in the city about the shooting of 19-year-old unarmed Laquan McDonald and the suppression of a videotape of his shooting that caught up her predecessor and also the mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel. So she's come in with her own platform, a lot of ideas. She's an incredibly smart thinker on criminal justice reform and super charismatic. I'm really excited. It's going to be fun.
All right. So October 25th, the Reskin Theater in Chicago, still tickets. Come see us and Kim Fox. And then we're doing our conundrum show, our annual conundrum show live in Boston on December 6th at the Wilbur Theater. And for that wonderful show, we're also going to have a special guest, which is They Might Be Giants, is going to perform with us. And they'll be the house band for the evening. So please join us on October 25th in Chicago and then December 6th in Boston. For information and tickets, go to slate.com/live. Slate.com/live. In the New York Times this week, Peter Baker argued that Donald Trump is the first really independent president since the Civil War. There are several exhibits to go along with this extraordinary claim. One was the recent quickie deal that Trump pulled with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer to extend the debt ceiling and extend government spending as is until December. Exhibit B, which had not happened at the time of the article but has happened now, is his flirtation with a DACA deal, a deal to keep dreamers, people, children brought to the U.S. Illegally when they were quite young, who were grown up here and of Americans and all but papers, to keep them in the country. On Wednesday night, Pelosi and Schumer leaked that they had an agreement with Trump for legislation that would keep those dreamers in the country and also provide some border security funding. The third exhibit is the Trump's own viciousness towards his members of his own party, his consistent beating of the Republican leadership and other Republicans has made some people think, well, he's not acting like a Republican. So, Emily, are you persuaded? Is he, Donald Trump, an independent?
No, I thought this thesis was completely ridiculous, to be honest, with all due respect to Peter Baker. And there were a couple of other versions of it over the weekend, too. I mean, it seems to me that, so first of all, this is a very small amount of deal making and possible deal making after 8 months of riding the hard right. And I think what we're really seeing is a transformation of the Republican Party. I mean, it's true that Trump is made clear he has no fondness for Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan and a few senators like Jeff Flake in Arizona. But the base is with him and he is with the base. I mean, one of the things I read this week that astounded me is that of Republicans who say they voted for Trump in the primary, 98% approve of his performance in office. Now, that's not all the Republicans, because the people who say they didn't vote for him in the primary, and by the way, that number of self-reporting has declined. So there are more people backing away from their professed support of him. And among those people, I think we're at around like 2/3 or 68%, something like that, approval. But still, Trump has a significant number of people in the base with him, and they are sticking to him like glue. And so the notion that he is the engine of a third party as opposed to a takeover, perhaps hostile in some ways, of the Republican Party just seems to me nuts, not to mention all the traditional arguments for why the two-party duopoly in the United States is really hard to crack. And then the last thing is just the idea of Trump starting a new party as opposed to just being all in it for himself. I just think that is silly, to be honest. John?
Well, I think like all debates, we have to define our terms. And I think this piece in particular got the problem was that it was kind of sent around, particularly on Twitter, just by the headline. So some people thought independent meant moderate, and that's obviously not true. You could be an independent and be further to the right than the Republican Party. So I think what Peter was trying to argue is that he has no particular allegiance to the party And that's true in some ways, and we've outlined those ways. The other obviously being that he was not a Republican for very long before he decided to run. The reason that he's not an independent is not necessarily anything that Donald Trump has to do. It's the what the Republican leaders are doing, which is clinging to him pretty strongly still, because they see him as the vehicle for their policies. Despite the criticisms, despite the mishandling of Charlottesville and what that pointed to, which was a lot of underlying fears they had during the campaign, you still have the leaders of the Republicans in the House and the Senate four square behind him. You have most of the Republicans in Congress, though they grumble behind the scenes, totally in lockstep with him because they worry about that base that you were talking about, Emily. So from that, in that sense, if the argument of the piece was just he's not aligned to a party and he wasn't really trying to make a claim about actually starting a third party or make a claim about his moderation, the party structure is still totally wrapped around him because he's the guy who can raise the money in the party and because he's got that base of voters who are likely to be the ones that turn out in 2018 and because a lot of those Republicans don't want to see primary challenges from that base that he has, which can maybe not defeat them but can cause them to spend a great deal of money and make every day a painful one.
And I mean, neither of you guys has really touched on what to me is the most obvious point, which is that on the overwhelming majority of policy matters, he has pursued extremely conservative policy goals. So if you look at the EPA that Scott Pruitt is leading, if you look at the Department of Education that Betsy DeVos is leading, if you look at what he's doing in the Clean Power Plan, the transgender service members, the refugee ban, Gorsuch, these are pretty typical conservative policy measures.
But wasn't that my first point, that he's not a moderate?
And mine. We didn't enumerate.
All right, so you didn't enumerate. I guess
really. Can I just say this though? The starting the comment with the most obvious thing, which neither of you mentioned, is that like really necessary?
But well,
as I listened to you guys frame it, I didn't. I think the specificity is the key. I mean, so forgive me. Forgive me.
Friendly way adding good specifics to our
right.
Our sweeping and undetailed generalizations.
John, on DACA, on this deal that Pelosi and Schumer say they've reached. I mean, is it possible that there's really a deal which will have no wall funding and where he'd screw over Jeff Sessions as attorney general?
Here to me is actually what was the greater freak out in the political coverage of the president over the last week. I think the notion that the president is independent from his party and does what he wants when he wants is in some sense axiomatic. It's what he does all the time. It's what he did in the campaign where he broke from Republican orthodoxy on tax cuts, on entitlements. When he flirts with taxing the rich, that's breaking with Republican orthodoxy. Like, he just does what he wants. He doesn't have a fixed ideology and he sloshes around all over the place. So in that sense, he is independent, if you want to define your terms that way. But I thought the thing that was nuttier was when the president makes a 3-month emergency deal with the Democrats, suddenly people were saying, this is it. He's going to go his like new way. It's a pivot. And well, he's either pivoting, but people have claimed he's going to pivot like 98 previous times, if not 198. It's more likely that he pivots and pivots and pivots and pivots and pivots here and pivots there. And it's unpredictable. But
known as like whirling around like a top.
But to David's point or the question about DACA, did he make a deal? Two things are notable to me that he probably did make a deal. Like there is some evidence in both what he said and in the way he said it over a pretty long period of time that he doesn't want to actually, though he said during the campaign he would rescind DACA and be harsh about it. Subsequent to that, he's been actually pretty consistent in saying these 800,000 shouldn't be just kicked out of the country. So he's trying to use it, as I think we mentioned last week, as a bargaining chip for the wall. So yes, that's what he's into doing. Now, what did Pelosi and Schumer try and box him in after a conversation? Probably. What's notable to me is the absolute roaring furnace of response from the Make America Great crowd, from Breitbart, Steve King, Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham.
Ann Coulter.
Freaked out. Ann Coulter said this morning in response to a tweet by the president, who doesn't want Donald Trump impeached now? And essentially, what he's done by their lights is go back on a promise. Well, he's done that like on a thousand different things. It's just that this is obviously in the issue set that was central to his rise and so important to his supporters. Now the question is, how does he respond to that? And this will give us some sense of whether there's any possibility for a deal, because A, you know, he doesn't want to lose his supporters, but B, any deal on a long-term deal about immigration or infrastructure or anything requires more than just being able to see how you might be able to put a deal together. It requires a long and sustained period where the people you're making the deal with can trust you. And so Democrats have to trust the president that he's not going to undermine them if they make a deal with him. And Republicans have to trust him that he's not going to sell out more than the little bit that he needs to get the Democratic support. That long sustained act of trust and consistency, which is usually the bedrock of any of these complicated bipartisan deals, is not something that he's shown in anything he's done as a politician.
One piece of this, the larger discussion about does he represent an independent political force, that does ring true to me is as Jonathan Rauch, my
spirit animal,
has written over the past couple of years, it is quite true. There's an increasingly large number of Americans who don't really believe in politics, who don't like politics, who don't trust politics, who have no faith in the give and take of it, and who are looking for almost extra political solutions from their politicians. They just want someone to come in and just, I'm just going to do it. And Trump's simplicity and roughness was very appealing to them. And it is true that he has given voice to that group, and he's given a center of gravity for that group to coalesce around. It's not centrism, and it's not independence. It's not even a party structure, but it is something. And what does make you realize that if there was someone who was less lazy than Trump, someone who did have ideological beliefs or an actual kind of agenda, who could harness that force, it would be incredibly dangerous. It's the Trump's own kind of incompetence and chaos has not made it that dangerous. I mean, it's made it unsettling, but so far is not dangerous. But I think that it does represent something new. And it's very unclear to me when Trump vanishes, does that group remain as a kind of an arm of the Republican Party, a kind of vicious sheathed arm of the Republican Party, or does it go elsewhere? Does it melt away? I just don't know. But it has a kind of form that it didn't have 2 years ago.
I mean, the fact that it's Trump who has embodied that utterly vague do it message, that explains why you would see it as dangerous. But I also think we don't exactly know that it's dangerous, because some of those people were drawn to Bernie Sanders. So if you're defining dangerous as right wing, there's also a kind of inchoate populist.
Finish the thought.
Just that the frustration with government can come on both the left and the right. And maybe you think it's equally dangerous in either direction because it's sort of this bubbling up populism that doesn't necessarily attach itself to a set of policies. It's like kind of just anger. And in that sense, then maybe it's dangerous on either level. I guess I just am not sure. It seems to me like it's kind of roving. It could attach itself to a different kind of ideology than the nativism we see now.
Well, that is a sense in which it's independent from the two parties. If you have 12% of the Sanders voters voting for Trump, then it does operate outside the parties. The problem is that even Donald Trump, with all of his talent for grabbing that, for making those iron filings align, the problem is that once you govern, you have to compromise or to get anything done. I mean, he tried it the first route with healthcare, didn't work. You know, he's trying something and flirting, doing something interesting. In fact, fully in the promise, much more of the promise of the Trump campaign than the way he's actually governed so far, is much more, to me, would have been much more expected that he would have come in and said, I was a crazy disruptive candidate, now watch this, and then tried to do an infrastructure deal with Democrats or just scramble Washington in a way that was different than the way he did, which was just to be even more partisan than an existing partisan structure. So this new thing that he's flirting with is interesting. We'll see if it goes anywhere, see if it's more than just a couple of meetings and 1 3-month deal. But even the hint of it is causing this absolute backlash from his base. And that's a constraint on the other side. So you have the constraint that didn't work in healthcare, and now you have the constraint that's hurting him here. And that's those are the compromises and constraints that are the difference between campaigning and governing. So that you make the alignment to govern. I mean, sorry, you make the alignment to get elected, but then those filings go back to their scattered position because the things you do to govern, you lose control. They lose their alignment.
The other thing about DACA, unlike that 3-month deal, which just seemed to me like, you know, who was really in Trump world going to like throw in the towel over it? I mean, DACA, you can see why Trump is drawn to it. It's broadly popular. If he makes this deal, he will get great headlines all over the place. But it is the hill that his base is willing to die on. I mean, this really matters to them. This was it. And I don't think a lot of those folks are going to easily forgive him for this kind of compromise. I mean, it would be, I think, the most progressive, if you pass the DREAM Act, that would be the most progressive federal move on immigration. Like, I can't remember. I'm not even sure what to compare it to, really. Something in the 60s, maybe. I mean, I guess amnesty, maybe, sort of, under Reagan. Anyway, it would be a big deal. And it's fascinating to me that he has picked this issue. And I don't imagine that it was like super strategic. I mean, it fell on his lap. He had this lawsuit. He had Jeff Sessions breathing down his neck to do something. But now he's sort of launched himself into like one of the most divisive battles possible.
And also, this could be Schumer and Pelosi messing with him. I mean, you know, so FDR, they used to say that one person would walk in and he would say, yes, yes, fine, fine. And then the person with the totally opposite viewpoint would walk into his office and he'd say, yes, yes, fine, fine. And everybody would think he agreed with him. And then at the end, he'd kind of like run to the open room and make the deal and it would be done. What he didn't have at the time is the person who went in with and met with him didn't go out and issue a press release, which is what Pelosi and Schumer have done. Trump could very well have said, well, yes, we'll do this. And it could have been in that kind of nebulous part of the negotiation. And basically, Pelosi and Schumer have tried to lock in the gains of whatever they got last night. And they basically put him in a spot. So he may not have agreed to everything they said he's agreed to.
I know.
But he's also tweeting Thursday morning, right?
Quite
he's
right.
Like,
quite right.
Who
quite
would
right.
ever want the Dreamers to leave? And I haven't made a deal yet, but
quite
don't
right.
worry. It will include. And oh, by the way, we're going to repaint the wall and that's going to be building it. I mean, that's
so
basically what he said.
That's super.
What was to repaint the wall?
He said renovate yeah. existing parts of yeah. the wall. Like, that's really quite a chant. You know, that'll really get the base fulfilled.
So that point is a really good one because Ann Coulter wasn't responding to what Pelosi and Schumer said. She was responding to an actual tweet by the president in which the president said they had been in our country for many years through no fault of their own, brought in by parents at a young age. And that's the thing that Coulter was responding to. So you're right. That's important.
Just one final point on this. Do you either of you think there is desire in the country for a third party? I think we all agree that Trump is an unlikely champion or creator or Edison of that party because he lacks the discipline and doesn't seem to care enough or have principles. But do you think that the force that he's animated or some other force actually represents a potential third party, or is that all dream because it's unsustainable in our system?
I think there is a hunger for it, and I still think it's unsustainable in our system. Like, the system's just not built for it. But I do think that among exactly the people you were talking about, people who just think politics is busted and they're tired of thinking that no matter who's in government, it's not really working for them. Yeah. I mean, these are old and kind of tarnished brands, Republicans and Democrats, right? Like, if you could have a brand new brand that seemed to actually deliver and to me, it just seems like pie in the sky, both structurally and then in terms of what they would actually do.
John?
I agree. The appetite is there and will be there more. The more people are disappointed, the more they have an appetite for something else. And the Trump phenomenon still exists, whether the president delivers for them or not.
All right. This episode of the Gabfest is brought to you by Aura Frames. Are you looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura Frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It is super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. Aura Frames, in the notes that I have here, says moms like Aura Frames. I'm here to tell you that is like the truest statement in the world. I gave my mother an Aura frame. She absolutely loves it. She's also always hectoring me to keep adding new photos to her Aura frame so that she's got great new photos every week. So think about giving your mother or grandmother or aunt or sister or friend an Aura frame for Mother's Day. It was named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things. Aura frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages. And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code GABFEST at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. We are thrilled to have with us Frank Foer, longtime friend of GABFEST, friend of ours, former Slate colleague for me once back in the day, who's the author of a new manifesto, World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. I've worn my Facebook shirt, Frank, to goad you.
I'm so ignoring it.
You can't ignore it.
Why do you have a Facebook shirt? That's just ridiculous.
Because back in the day when I was editing Slate, Don Graham took all the top sort of Washington Post company brass out to Silicon Valley for several days of meetings with people. And we went to Facebook and met with Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg, and they gave us free t-shirts. And I have it. And I'm going to the gym later, and it just is like a good gym t-shirt.
What you can't see.
Facebook, though.
What you can't see is plots is Google underwear.
But Google can see it.
We'll have a showing of
which
that
I bought
later
on Amazon. So, also, Frank, you're talking to me this morning, and my wife is interviewing you this evening. So
a day bookended by Rosenplatz's.
Wow.
What a good day.
Will you survive?
So what is the fundamental argument of World Without Mind?
So the argument is, ever since we've been human beings, we've had tools, and these tools have been extensions of us, and they've been really great. They've allowed us to do all sorts of wonderful things, and you could even argue that technology is one of the things that defines us as human beings. But over the course of the last 10 years or so, we've had the emergence of all these incredible new technologies. And these companies that produce these technologies have a very strong view of human nature and how humans should interact with these technologies. And so my argument is that these companies have not just a view, but they're able to impose their view because of their economic power. And my concern is that that power gives them enormous control over markets, over information, culture, and ultimately over democracy. And so rather than just sitting back and marveling at these things and enjoying their fruits, we should also be considering with a very skeptical eye the implications of them. Because look, so we've always had tools, we've been merging with our machines, but we're much, much more integrated with these machines than anything else. And so the companies that run them deserve to have pressure put on them.
Yeah. So I was...
Word.
I buy it. I was thinking about antitrust law as I was reading and thinking about your book and whether it is equal to this task. I read an interview with you where you were talking about how one of the sparks for you for writing, I think, was when Amazon started to try to bully the Hachette Publishing Group right into selling its e-rights for very cheap. And of course, the irony of that moment was that the Justice Department came cracked down on the book publishers instead of on Amazon. And that just seems indicative to me. I haven't done enough thinking about how our antitrust principles line up with this moment, but I'm skeptical, especially as I watch the Europeans seem to do a better job of regulating. I'm skeptical that American law, as currently conformed, is up to the task.
Yeah, it's super interesting. If you look at the way that the Europeans are approaching the problem, you could argue that they're doing a more American job of approaching it than the Americans, that if you look back in the history of our communication technologies, you can see that ever since the founders, we've been very, very skeptical of communication monopolies, and we've tried to constrain them and prevent them from extending into the next thing. So the Postal Service was a monopoly, the first monopoly in this realm, and we prevented them from getting into the telegraph business. And then when Western Union achieved a monopoly in telegraphy, we constrained them from getting into the telephone business, and so on and so forth, all the way through the Microsoft case in the Clinton administration, back when Plotz and I are Slate oldsters, and we were here when Microsoft was getting sued by the government. In retrospect, that was actually an important case. The case was settled in the early days of the Bush administration, but I don't think Google would have been possible were it not for that the government's prosecution of Microsoft, because Microsoft was super scared about getting broken up, and it really reined itself in when it came to operating the browser. And I've talked to a lot of people at Google, and they say, "Yeah, we would have gotten creamed by Microsoft were it not for that case." And so, I think what the Europeans are doing is really important. And our anti, you know, one of the facts is that these monopolies were kind of born at a moment when our regulatory system was super lax and when Chicago-style economics had kind of really taken over the regulatory state.
And yet, don't some people look at that Microsoft case and say that the argument Microsoft is making was borne out, which is when they were fighting against the Justice Department, they said, look, we can have our lunch stolen at any moment. All of this innovation doesn't create the network effects and doesn't allow us to bully the way you claim, because at any moment somebody can come up with a better idea, and because all somebody has to do is switch their operating system or switch their browser, there's much faster movement into the market, and that's what they would say Google did, which proved their argument.
Right. So that's a counterfactual history that we could argue both ways. And I know that there are people within the kind of historians of technology who argue it either way, and it kind of depends on your ideological predilection. I support antitrust, so I say, you know, Google was only born thanks to antitrust laws. Eric Schmidt's motto is competition is always a click away.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there is this lock-in that happens with networks. And so when you join up with a network, you tend to just stick with it because it becomes a pain in the ass to schlep to another network. And so I could use DuckDuckGo or some other, or Bing. When was the last time you used Bing, John Dickerson?
I was a righteous user of Bing when they advertised on the campaign.
I think it came up accidentally on my phone the other day, and I was so confused. Yeah. What is this?
Bing is around?
Right, exactly. Right.
Is it true, the story about Zappos and Amazon, which is that what you're describing is people get used to doing something that creates network effects that then allow those big companies to just keep it from being a click away. In theory, so basically when Amazon said, we want to buy Zappos,
yes.
Zappos said no. And then Amazon basically
buried Zappos in the search results.
Wasn't that diapers?
That's what they did to
that,
yeah.
It's diapers.
Oh,
diapers.
I thought it was Zappos too, though. And there's a Zappos story I remember somewhere, too. But anyway, they ended up buying Zappos.
But there's a Yelp story like that, too, about restaurant reviews, right?
There is.
So, Frank, one of the arguments that implicitly and explicitly you make, and I'll quote you from an interview, I worry that we're always being watched, when we're always being watched, we cease to feel comfortable thinking subversive original thoughts. There's an ecosystem of journalists and book publishers who are getting crushed in this new economy. It's their words that are necessary to be contemplative human beings. I'm not sure. I definitely don't share this gloom. I mean, you're speaking tonight at Sixth and I, an institution that didn't exist 20 years ago, a cultural institution which now brings intelligent discourse to Washington, D.C. in a way that wasn't there 20 years ago. It's not technology, but it's the fact that it can reach people technologically allows it to thrive. The realm of podcasts, the universe of discussion and of journalism that never existed, is thriving. Books are still being sold and created in enormous numbers. And I mean, I don't have the numbers, but I bet we're at a peak book sales for this country. And certainly there are kinds of journalism that have suffered, but there are new models that have arisen. And you have the New Yorker, I again would hazard, has the highest subscription numbers. The New York Times certainly has the highest subscription numbers that they've ever had. So how do you square that diversity of ideas and of new formats with your sense that the world of contemplation and of idea generation and sharing is being damaged?
Well, a lot of those businesses are incredibly tenuous. I mean, you could say that the New Yorker has higher numbers than it ever has, or that the New York Times has higher numbers than it ever has, but they're relative, I think, to their history. They're just kind of eking by, and I think the problem.
I don't think that's true. I mean, I think you can say
you're talking about money, right?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
I don't think that's true. I certainly don't think that's true of the New Yorker relative to where it was 20 years ago.
Okay, so it had a bad spell when it was overspending, and then Remnick's done a good job of. But I think if you were to talk to the business people at the New Yorker, they'd say it's in a way the problems were so fixable 20 years ago because it just meant reining in spending, and there was kind of a logic to circulation. But the problem now is one of dependence, and we know this in journalism really clearly, which is that in order to grow traffic. In order to grow revenue, you have to achieve volumes of traffic that are kind of unprecedented in terms of the scale of audience. But it's also the dependence that we have as an industry on Facebook. And the same thing is true for books, that books have never been as dependent on Amazon. And so let's just unpack the Facebook example, because I think that it allows us to get at some of the costs of this dependence, unless you want to. You know, you're wearing the jersey, so you feel free to pipe in their defense. That this is what I experienced, and I think that this is what a lot of people have experienced with Facebook, which is that in order to succeed on Facebook, you have to play by Facebook's rules. Right now, we see this with video, that Facebook has decided that video is the thing. And so that means that all the journalistic institutions that are dependent on Facebook have to transfer resources into investing in video, and that comes at a cost, right? I mean, nobody has infinite amount of resources where you can just kind of expand what you're doing into a new thing. You have to make choices. And so the choice that the entire industry is making, driven by Facebook, is to shift from word to video images. And maybe video is great a lot of the time, but I think in aggregate, it's probably not a healthy sort of shift. Or let's look at politics, where I mean, this is really, I think, at the core of a lot of my beef. And it was something that I didn't really even fully appreciate until this last election unfolded, which is that Facebook has this illusion of personal choice. But of course, we know that there isn't choice there because everything is sorted by an algorithm. And it's a feedback loop. And it's trying to give you what you want in order to keep you clicking. And in politics, that's super dangerous because, you know, on the one hand, we can say, all right, our system has never been so polarized. But really, that polarization has created two hive minds that Facebook has nurtured. And within those hive minds, you have people who are highly susceptible to they're getting what they want to hear, which makes them, I think, worse citizens. But it also makes them highly susceptible to fake news and propaganda, because fake news and propaganda conform. And it's also diminished the authority. Facebook has also diminished the authority of media. So Facebook is this just giant stew of stuff that's thrown at you. And the most important thing is the headline, not where it comes from. And so it's had the effect of diminishing the authority of media.
Elite media. Yeah. I mean, when you talk about the trade-offs, I thought one of the things you did a really good job of writing about is the sheep herding toward clickbait stories. We're like, yeah, fine, let's read about Cecil the Lion. But all of the huge fire hose of resources directed toward Cecil the Lion, instead of one obvious thing, is just local news coverage. For my own book reporting, I've been trying to rely on local news coverage in the way that you have to do if you're trying to write about something happening in a city that you don't live in. And it is amazing how thin it is right now. It's really been a lesson for me in understanding what that looks like when local news coverage kind of dries up and withers.
Yeah, that's a pretty great example.
Also, Cecil the Lion makes local news coverage a lot cheaper too, because you just replay the footage of Cecil the Lion reporting on something that takes a lot of time and effort, and you have to have a beat reporter, and you have to, you know, maybe there aren't pictures, so you have to spend a couple of days more trying to find a way to tell a story that doesn't have pictures in a dynamic way that people will watch. It's easier to do the Cecil the Lion.
And some of it is spinach. I mean, it used to be, before we had Chartbeat and all of our traffic metrics, that you could fool yourself into thinking that the investigative dive into
corruption in the district attorney's office was getting a ton of eyeballs. Like, nobody had to really think when it was a piece of paper that we were reading, who was reading what. And that was an illusion that newspapers were able to perpetuate that was very useful for driving local news coverage. And now we've, it's sort of like, now we know, and it's not pretty what we've
but
learned.
I think there are two different things here. Is there great work and useful work and work that serves the public citizens being created and created in new ways and
yes,
new forms?
There is.
It is. Mm-hmm. And but, so I don't think
I agree with that.
I think the problem, which I think you're absolutely right about, is that the way that we are filtered. I mean, it's the filter, the way we're seeing it, the way Facebook guides how we see it, the way it reinforces our biases. That to me is the problem. But I don't think there is an absence of the actual culture.
Well, no, I don't either. I don't either. I mean, look at if you look at something like BuzzFeed. You know, BuzzFeed is many, many things. It's produced some of the greatest investigative reporting of the last generation. It's nurtured some incredibly impressive journalists. And, you know, kudos to them for that. And they've done it in creative sort of ways. But at the same time that they've done that, they've also helped kind of usher in this culture of clickbait journalism. I wouldn't say we're at a crisis where all this good stuff has ceased to exist. It's still being produced in droves, but its authority has diminished because we live in a world of trade-offs.
There's also such a star system with like the things that really do pop and hit and go viral, and then all the things that don't. It just feels like some things become huge because of Facebook or Twitter or whatever, and maybe that's deserved, maybe it's fine, but in the end it has that feeling of like fast food or a big chain restaurant or like movie stars who get paid a ton of money and then everyone else gets a smaller amount relative to that.
Is there any way in which you can argue that Jeff Bezos and his success at Amazon, which has then allowed him to do what he's doing with the Washington Post, is a model for refertilizing the old? So if you argue the Washington Post has gotten better and is more powerful than it used to be, and that's in part because of him, and he is able to do that because of his success in this other area.
And I'll cite a second example, which is the magazine that you work for. The Atlantic has just been bought by Laureen Powell Jobs.
So you're saying essentially it's okay to accept rent-seeking monopolists because they will beneficently fund news organizations. Right. And so,
just like they did in the newspapers of the last century.
But
they used to build museums and concert halls, right? Like Carnegie mailed all his money and then he gave back. The problem is it's up to their whim, right? Like Jeff Bezos wants to sell the Washington Post.
Well, I guess also if you're just trying to figure out the aggregate, good and bad. Like,
there are two problems. One is that journalists tend to be incredibly narcissistic, right? So every conversation we have with the taxi driver becomes a column, right? But so I think that we can't just judge these people by their beneficence, right? We did not judge Andrew Carnegie in his day, or we didn't immunize him against government regulation because he built libraries, and we shouldn't do that with these people. And secondly, I think we still don't really know the answer to the question of whether these people are good for journalism. With Marty Baron as the editor of the Washington Post and a strong editor, any owner is going to look good if you give that guy the space to do his job. I'm optimistic about the new owner of the Atlantic, but if you read the things that Jeff Bezos has said over time about his responsibility as an elite, I think it would cause you to at least leave it as an open question whether he's going to be good as an owner. And so it's worth I'll just spend 30 seconds. If you looked at the past generation of newspaper owners who were also monopolistic rent seekers, who were very powerful and cozied up to power and were highly imperfect, they also had a sense of their power and they created checks on it. And so the idea of objectivity was a check that was created on the power of newspaper owners and a separation between the business side of newspapers and the editorial side. They had letters to the editor. They published corrections. There was a real sense of balance that was built into that system. because there was a sense of noblesse oblige, for better or for worse, that they had. If you listen to Bezos, he talks about responding to the market. And that's his view of the world, is that his job isn't to lead people to the good. His job is to give people what they want.
One thing I would advise for your World Without Mind 2, The Return.
The afterward.
Is your three main subjects are Facebook, Google, and Amazon as companies, and about the sort of the market effects and the software effects. I actually think that Apple deserves a bigger piece of this, because the biggest change that I see in the world is not necessarily in software, but in hardware. And the fact that we, all of us, have this device in our hands and it's nibbling our attention in this way every second. And that, like, when I think about what worries me about the technological future, it's actually less some of the things you talk about, and it's more that how our ability to concentrate is being grabbed and destroyed by these attention-hoarding devices.
That is fair. I mean, I think that Apple is really a platform above all for these other guys, and the way that they try to engineer things to addict us. But clearly Apple's phones are engineered to addict us as well. And addict us in a totally different sort of way, where we keep wanting the next thing and the next upgrade. And they've done the most effective job of creating the sense of magic around their product.
So Frank, your book is just out. People will find it by searching for it on Google. They will buy it on Amazon. They will see their friends referring to it on Facebook. Have these platforms dinged you at all?
So far as I know, no. It would be
the secret plan.
I'd be so happy if they dinged me.
I mean, right, no, that's true. Yes. Although not if you were like wiped from the web, that wouldn't be so great.
Yeah, proof of concept.
Yeah, I feel a measure of conflict about the extent to which I both check my Amazon number relentlessly, that I self-promote myself through the platforms, and I can see just like the rank hypocrisy of my argument when I'm doing these things. Uh-huh. Fortunately, I didn't call for everybody to unilaterally disarm in this world, so maybe that exempts me.
Maybe you're burning down the master's house with the master's tools. There's like some, it's all, you have a
That's
secret plan
happening.
Of your own.
That's what's happening. Thank you.
If we just stick with you.
All right.
World Without Mind by Franklin Foer is the book that people are going to be talking about this fall. It is a great argument starter. It's a great subject of discussion. You should go get it so you can be a participant, so you can be culturally fluent. Frank, thanks for coming by.
Thank you so much.
The future of America is in your hands.
This is not a movie trailer, and it's not a political ad, but it is a call to action. I'm Mila Atmos, and I'm passionate about unlocking the power of everyday citizens. On our podcast, Future Hindsight, we take big ideas about civic life and democracy and turn them into action items for you and me. Every Thursday, we talk to bold activists and civic innovators to help you understand your power and your power to change the status quo. Find us at futurehindsight.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
What happened? Hillary Clinton's new book arrives in stores. Maybe it has arrived in stores. It is very hard to perform an autopsy on your own corpse, but she manages to do that. I would call this book, which incidentally I haven't read. I've read bits from it and I've read about it, but I don't have a copy of it. But from what I've
Me
read.
Me neither. I'm equally read, fessing okay. up about that.
Yeah, okay. I might as well do the same.
All right.
Okay.
All right, here we go.
The book we have not read.
The book we have not read. But the book we have not read, I'm going to call Murder on the Orient Express. According to her telling, she was killed by James Comey, by Vladimir Putin, by her own emails, by her comments about the basket of deplorables, by her dutifulness, by sexism, by white racism, by the lack of enthusiasm of African-American voters, by a media double standard, by the stupid electoral college. It's all true, isn't it, Emily?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the question about this book is, does she blame herself enough, or is she still kind of dodgy about that? And then should it exist at all, which I think is ridiculous. Of course, she can write a book if she wants to. And then is the timing for it helpful to her progressive cause?
Here's the question about blaming herself. So the question is, A, could she ever blame herself enough
to pay the price some people would require her to pay to then listen to her other arguments.
Yes, that is a really good way to put it.
I think there are that it's not as perfectly obvious that she needs to go on for, you know, several chapters about how awful she is.
In order to earn the right to criticize or to name the other factors.
Right.
Emily, one of the things that she apparently talks about regretting is that she didn't bring bigger or bolder policy proposals to the table. That seems ludicrous to me. I don't think anyone would have taken...
That wasn't her style and just people wouldn't have believed her anyway?
Yeah, people wouldn't have believed her. I don't think it's reasonable for people to her brand was stability. Like that was the play. It's like I'm the adult. I mean, retrospectively, you can say, oh, if she'd only harnessed some of that populist anger herself and you know, gone further in her campaigns, maybe she would have done better. But that was that feels so Monday morning quarterbacking of somebody whose entire raison d'etre was that stability, calm, reason.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think from what I've read about the book and the excerpts I've read, there's a frustration with Bernie Sanders, this way in which he was promising purple ponies that were going to prance around the Christmas tree. And so was Donald Trump. And she couldn't do that. And I can completely imagine why that would be intensely enraging for her. But I also think you're right. And that to the degree that this was what sunk her, it had to do with being the establishment candidate at a moment when that was just not what the country wanted. Though one should also add, she did win the popular vote. So to say it wasn't what the country wanted is a little crazy.
Okay, well, sorry. Yeah, no, that's right. And that's when we evaluate 2016 to understand where the country is, there is a tendency to say, well, the country ratified this. But I think in David's long list of things that were contributory, although I think in all the things that contributed, I think Nate Silver has made a pretty good case for the Comey announcement. At the end, towards the end of the campaign.
In October,
playing, of all those things, playing a weighted role. So that all of those may have been contributors, and we can't necessarily put our finger on one. But if you had to put your finger on one or lose your house, I think the arguments for the Comey late breaking news are pretty well supported. But going back to what we were talking about earlier, like how much of a mea culpa does she need to do? There is a way in which, as she tries to see what she did wrong, it does help us then illuminate the way we think about campaigns. And just like her criticism of the media, which I think is well founded,
Yes. This
point that David makes illuminates something about the nature of our campaigns. Was this a campaign in which people wanted more policy papers? Have there ever been campaigns in which people wanted more policy papers? I mean, Barack Obama did not win because he had 17 papers on income inequality. He had a hope and change message, and he had the girding underneath to support it. But that was important, but it wasn't necessarily the winning thing. And that would go back even to her husband, who had plenty of policy chops, but the sense of empathy and the sense of fighting for people, the ability to make the kind of emotional appeal that President Trump was able to do and that Hillary Clinton had difficulty with, operates completely outside of the arena of policy changes.
You know what that also makes me think about is the way in which she was burdened by the expectation that everyone assumed she was going to win, right? I mean, that's another example for why she didn't promise purple ponies. She thought she would be held to that promise. Trump and Sanders didn't necessarily think that. And then Comey's intervention, the fact that Obama didn't freak out more about what he knew about Russian hacking. These are all premised on her certain victory.
Right.
I wonder if the single biggest gift this botched 2016 campaign could give us would be to just wipe away that assumption the next time that people will not prejudge and that we won't believe, you know, that 84% she's going to win number from the upshot or from 538. I think theirs was a little lower by election day. You know what I'm talking about? Like, yeah. That we'll just take it as a real race, like no matter what. And that's actually intensely important for how the campaign is covered and for the set of decisions people make who are in a position to really influence its outcome.
Although I would take you back to the time during the campaign where there were a host of people who said, you know, to even pretend that this is a real race is a total media creation. They're only doing it to get people to watch. And Hillary Clinton has won, and it's totally among the worst things the media does is to pretend that there's a real race when in fact the race is over and all of our data tells us that it's over.
Oh,
there was a
host of that. Yeah. Right? No, I agree, but I just feel like we got to blow that out of the water. Like those. That's not. Yeah. No.
Do you guys think she had that this book is her last act as a real big public figure? I just don't know what else she has in her.
I don't know. I mean, she's an incredibly energetic and determined person. I think it's amazing that this book is coming out now, that she is getting up and talking publicly. I mean, this is a person who, like, spent, as far as I can tell, about 3 minutes on the fainting couch before she just got back up again. And I hope that we do find, that she finds, and that the country finds, a really strong public role for her. I mean, I'm just always going to feel like we all owe her, and that women in particular owe her. There was something fated and doomed about the fact that the first female nominee of a major party for president was someone who came in, who came into public life as a wife who was laden with her husband's baggage and with all the freight of the 1990s Clinton administration. That was part of her problem. It's also part of why she was paranoid about news coverage and privacy, email server related. And I just, like, I want her to have a next act and to be, like, honored for the things that she has done, because she gets hated in such an over the top way. Like, it's people's anger toward her just seems to me, like, way out of proportion when you think about the things she's done. And I deeply see that she's flawed, but I just hear people talk about her in this way that just feels to me like it's just not fair.
And to the extent that she's unburdened by the self-imposed restraint that a campaign and the future in politics put on her, perhaps she can be, you know, she can deliver more to the conversation now than she could previously, where she had to be so restrained. One other thing I would just add quickly is that Thomas Frank, I thought, wrote a good piece in The Guardian in the sense that it represented a core complaint about her, and that it continues to be a debate. And another reason this is important for her to write this book is that it continues conversations in a new way about the future of politics and the future of the Democratic Party for those who are interested in that. And the argument essentially was that she, even in her book, doesn't recognize her or doesn't wrestle with enough and engage enough for the purposes of illumination the fact that she didn't talk about trade, outsourcing, immigration, opiates, deindustrialization, and all those other things, and Wall Street, enough to meet the needs of an electorate out there who are riled up about those things. And the reason that matters with respect to the book critique is that that's still a conversation going on in Democratic politics right now about whether anybody can speak to that group of people and how they would do it and who they would be. And do you do it through issue paper, policy papers, or do you do it through pie-in-the-sky proposals, which tend to be, you know, voters almost discount the pie-in-the-sky. They just like, it's like they say about holiday photographs. It's not that you ever capture the Mount Rushmore in your picture, but the fact that you took 72 pictures of it conveys how awed you were by the moment. And that's sort of the truth of political proposals. Even though it may not happen in reality, boy, are you committed to it.
Man, as an elitist, as a proud elitist, I find it also disturbing. I found that Frank piece unsettling, like that it was so populist. It was so positive that there's a left-wing populism, which isn't dangerous, which I don't think is true, but
and also, he was dismissing her in just the way that was bothering me. Anyway.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
All right, let's go to cocktail chatter. When John Dickerson is having his traditional five fingers of scotch, what will you be chattering about with the little Dickersons?
I ran into Mitch Daniels, the president of Purdue University and former governor of Indiana. And
Slate Political Gabfest guest.
Yeah. Well, not
how
only
did
Slate,
you leave out his most important credential?
Well, I was winding up to that. But you rushed in to seize the trophy. I was trying to figure out what title to give him because he's been a guest enough, and both as a president and as a governor, right? Wasn't he on when he was governor?
I don't know. No. But anyway, he has a...
No, just once.
He has a... anyway, I had a conversation with him about this program they have at Purdue that I didn't know about before. But it's an attempt to basically change the student debt equation for their students. So just to remind that there's $1.3 trillion in student debt out there. The average owed by a student is $37,000. What they do at Purdue is they change it from a debt model to an equity model. And essentially, Purdue, you can invest in the future of Purdue students. And the school itself has invested in them. And then what happens is when a student graduates, a portion of their income is then used to pay back their debts. So if they turn out to not get a job, then the hit is taken not by the student who can't pay their $37,000, but the hit is taken by the person who owns the share in this fund, and the fund is made up of all the students repaying. So you take a hit. You don't get 7%. You get 3% because some number of students. But if you're, but you invest in Purdue on the basis of the idea that, you know, it's a good school and most of the students are going to go out and get pretty decent jobs. So in other words, it just shifts the risk from the student who has this debt hanging over them to the shareholder. And the formula is adjusted so that, A, there's no interest. Okay, so that's important, which means you can take a job at an entry level that's going to have big upside later, knowing that you're not going to be accumulating interest payments while you can't pay off your student debt in those early years. Anyway, it just seemed like a very clever plan. And there's,
that's cool. I want to find out how that works, like how it works in the longer run, I mean.
Right, exactly. And what the inevitable criticism is and then how they get around it. But there's a piece that the NewsHour did on the 22nd of August about this that the president of Purdue, Mitch Daniels, pointed me to. So I thought that was interesting.
Emily, what is your chatter?
My chatter is about a new book called The Internationalists. It's by a couple of law professors of whom I am immensely fond, Ona Hathaway and Scott Shapiro. And it's really like an eye-opening book. I just never thought about war the way Ona and Scott write about it. Basically, their argument is that the Kellogg-Briand Pact, which is this sort of usually kind of forgotten agreement from 1928, which outlawed war, really did succeed in reducing war and especially in reducing invasions. And of course, the reason that this pact has been largely set aside is that it was followed by World War II and some other big invasions in the 1930s, which were kind of inconvenient. But Ona and Scott did this research over many decades, and they really are able to show a drop in the number of wars and invasions since then. And the other thing about this book, which is so appealing, is just it has these amazing character sketches of figures like Hugo Grotius, who is a Dutch philosopher, I think, in the 17th century, who wrote about war and was actually arguing for aggression being legal and letting the winner take the spoils, which is not where we ended up, thankfully. But anyway, it's one of many just really elucidating steps along the way. So it's called The Internationalists. I think the publishing date was this week, and it's by Ona Hathaway and Scott Shapiro.
Okay. My chatter is kind of a downer. It's actually very Bazelon style and subject matter.
Oh, which, good. Which is chattering about the Pence-Kobach voter commission insanity, because that was my other chatter.
No, God. It's my chatter is about a remarkable article and interactive that the Cincinnati Inquirer newspaper did called 7 Days of Heroin.
That is amazing.
Which is attempts to, they sent most of their staff, it seems like, out for a week in July just to watch heroin affect Cincinnati and the communities around Cincinnati. So they're with cops who are dealing with people ODing. They're with courts handling cases of addicts who have shot up around their own kids. They're at narcotic support groups with people trying to quit, with a family that's lost a son to an overdose, with a prostitute selling sex for drug money, people struggling to try to stay away from heroin and fentanyl, kids who are abandoned and neglected and abused. And then there's just sort of a climbing body count that associates it as time and the 7 days goes on. It is very, very sad and very grueling, and is a really remarkable picture of this terrible scourge that the country is experiencing in the Cincinnati Inquirer. I want to recommend a podcast. We're doing some Slate podcast recommendations in Slate podcast world. And so this week, I got a little bit of a Homer recommendation, which is the XXX Gabfest. So this XXX Gabfest is a podcast that is hosted by Noreen Malone and June Thomas and my own wife, Hanna Rosen. And it's about feminism, gender, sexuality, health, politics, culture, other interests, other issues of interest to women. And it's great. I get to talk to Hanna all the time. And she's really very, very smart and very interesting and very funny and provocative. And I get that hours and hours every week. And yet still, I listen to the XX Gabfest because even there, I get to hear not only her brilliant thoughts that she hasn't expressed at home when she's talking about dinner, and also Noreen and June are just delightful and lively and bright, and it's always a great conversation. So
it is such a fun show and so smart and incisive, and really like sitting around with, I mean, you don't get to talk, but I don't get to talk to Hanna all the time, and I really enjoy getting to have a pretend one-way conversation with her and June and Noreen. It's great.
Yeah. So listen to the XX Gabfest, which posts Thursday morning every other week. That's our show for today. Jocelyn Frank produces the Political Gabfest. Izzy Rode is our researcher. Kevin is gone. I was just going to say Kevin's name, but he's gone. Forgotten him. Totally.
No,
out
we
of
have
here.
Not forgotten.
Oh yeah, this we still remember necessary. Him. Still remember him. And you should follow us on Twitter at Slate Gabfest. It's where there's all sorts of interesting things that we are posting that Izzy is passing on. So follow us on Twitter at Slate Gabfest. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson and David Plotz, thanks for listening. Please come to our live show in Chicago and our live show in Boston. You can get tickets at slate.com/live. Talk to you next week.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.